Well, I was originally scheduled to speak in November, but due to popular demand, I got moved up ahead. So I will be talking about week three today. I've already covered week one and two. And today we're going to be talking about the body image and shroud history. So prior, in end of week two, I had argued that the shroud is not a medieval fake, but it is from the first century and was used to wrap a crucified person that died. But I never argued why it's Jesus of Nazareth. So I'm going to briefly talk about that. And we see that it is Jesus of Nazareth because the features of the shroud match only one person in human history that has been crucified, that has been scourged, that has a side wound, facial wounds, crown of thorns, no broken bones, and buried in a fine linen cloth. And the Shroud of Turin has all these features that depicts Jesus of Nazareth. So at this point, I've argued that the Shroud of Turin is not a medieval fake. It's not a painting. It is from first century, and it is Jesus of Nazareth. But how can we determine Jesus was resurrected from the dead? Does the shroud show that? And I'm going to argue this morning that I believe it does, through how the image was created. So since the shroud wrapped Jesus, and it's not artwork of any kind, there must be some sort of non-artistic method that was used for the image of Jesus to get on that cloth. And there are several theories proposed, and we're going to look at some of those theories, and I'm going to argue which one I believe is the best theory. So we've covered a lot of the scientific features of the shroud, and we're going to have to match that to the theory. So I'm going to select some of the features that I presented in that first week. The first is the photographic negative effect. And the one on the left is what you would see with your naked eyes if you saw the shroud. But if you took a picture of it and then inverted it, that's what you would see on the right. Also said that there's depth encoding information on it. And I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about this. So you can see here his face and then his body and then his arms. And it looks like almost like a topographical rendition of Jesus' face and his chest and his body. So all this is from a two-dimensional picture, which is very interesting because this is the only two-dimensional picture that encodes three-dimensional information. And the question is, why is that? Why does this shroud is able to encode three-dimensional information? And I'm just going to hopefully try to explain this to you. The reason is because the areas that are darker is closer to the cloth. So we see this in the facial areas, the hair, chest, the arms. They're darker near the center. And so it is closer to the cloth. As you go away and towards the edge of the body, it gets fainter and fainter. And this, we see this throughout all parts of the body. And so as it gets fainter, then it is further away from the cloth. And they confirmed this through the VP8 image analyzer in 1976. But they also theorized this earlier, much earlier, after they took the first photograph and then also when they took the second photograph in the 30s. And they did some crude experiments, and they were able to sort of determine that, yeah, there's encoded information, but it was really through the VP8 that we were able to see this pictorially. Again, there's nothing that's been added to the cloth to make the image. So there's no paint, dye, pigment, or any medium. The discoloration is only from the dehydration and oxidation of the fibers. And it is only on the topmost fibers of a yarn. So here we see the warp yarn, a warp yarn, and then the weft yarn. And only the top 1, 2, 3 fibers of a 200-fiber yarn has been discolored. It's not all of the fibers inside of a yarn that has been discolored. And only the surface of a fiber is discolored. So on the inside of a fiber, it is not colored. Also mentioned about the halftone effect, and that is when a picture is just comprised of dots. As you get closer to the image, the only thing you see is dots, and then the same thing with the shroud. This is a close-up of the nose, and you can't really tell that until you get farther away. I mentioned about angle encoding, and angle encoding is not something that is found. I just made up that term in order to describe this effect. But what I'm trying to convey is that there's certain things that are at the angle of the body, like the sides of the body, that are either less showed up or doesn't even show up at all. Like, for example, there are no ears on the shroud. And this is the front top of the head, and this is the back, and there is nothing in between. Now, if the shroud was covered around here like this, it was touching the head, but there is no imaging at the top of the head. So you have to account for that. Whatever theory that you propose has to explain this as well. And same with the hands. Here's the hands right here, and there is no thumb. Now, there are some theories as to why the thumbs are not shown. Some theorize it's because a nail was placed through the wrist, and then it ruptured the median nerve, and then it collapsed the thumb. That could be one aspect, but I think another aspect to it is this angle encoding. With the hands, we also see sort of like an X-ray effect. We see the metacarpal and the finger bones of the hand. And also we see this in the teeth over here. And I believe this is the teeth that we observe. And the X-ray effect only goes down several millimeters deep from the surface. It is not as though we see through the entire head like a typical X-ray. So the theory has to account for why the X-ray effect is only piercing down a few millimeters. The image is hyper-realistic, so it is not like someone who just drew this or painted it. It looks anatomically perfect. We talked about the side strip. There's about 3.5 inch wide strip that is along the left side over here, and it has been reattached through a seam like this, which is a seam that is found in Masada. There is no breakage or smearing of the blood. There is no decomposition. So whatever theory that we propose, the best theory would align with the most of these features. So if you have a body and you have a cloth, we have to think about how can the image of the body get onto the cloth? And there's two ways. Either the information from the body was transmitted to the cloth. So for example, maybe a gas was emitted from the body. And then it came from the body, and then it somehow discolored the cloth. Or light reflected off the body or emitted from the body, and then it landed on the cloth. Or some sort of radiation or neutrons or something came from the body, and then it came on the cloth. Does that make sense? Now, there's actually another way, is for the opposite direction, for the cloth to go onto the body. And that's a little bit harder to understand because that doesn't really happen in real life. But it's just the backwards, just reverse direction. So it's either the information came from the body to the cloth or the cloth went to the body. So those are the only two mechanisms that we can transfer information from the body to the cloth. So the top non-artistic body image formation theories, the Maillard reaction, which is the vapor, neutron radiation, corona discharge, and the cloth collapse. And I'm going to be going through all of these. So the Maillard reaction was proposed by Ray Rogers. He was the lead chemist on STIRP. And it's a chemical reaction between the amino acids and sugars. And we see this in the browning of foods, steaks, fried dumplings, and cookies. This is all the Maillard reaction. And so what Ray Rogers is proposing is that some sort of like ammonia gas came off from the body as it died, and then it was reacted to some sugars that was on the cloth itself. But there's some issues with the Maillard reaction. One is, if a gas is coming off a body, how can it produce a high-definition image? Gas would just be radiating, and you're not going to see a perfect image. You're just going to see a big blob, really. But we don't see that. You know, we see a hyper-realistic image. And how would it encode a depth information with that? Now, you might be able to sort of, if it was a far distance away, so like, you know, if it was very far, you would get little gas, and then if it was very close, you'd get more gas. But this is only on the millimeters, centimeters away, and so how can there be that much gas difference for that short of a distance? The head gap, so as I mentioned, the cloth was surrounding the head, and so how can gas account for that lack of imaging at the head gap? The angle encoding, we see no ears and no thumbs. How can that explain that? There's no decomposition. So as ammonia gas is coming from the body, eventually it's going to fully decompose, but we don't see any evidence of decomposition on the shroud. The blood stains are intact. So maybe someone can theorize, well, you know, he partially was decomposing and then someone took the body out. But that is countered by the fact that the blood stains are intact. So no one could have actually removed the body prior to full decomposition. And there is uniform imaging on the ventral and the dorsal sides. So how would the gas uniformly go up and down to produce a uniform image? The neutron radiation theory is proposed by Robert Rucker. And he proposes neutron radiation was emitted from the body, and it was emitted straight up and down from the body. It's a vertically collimated radiation. And so this is the same thing as the gas. The radiation cannot be going out like a light bulb, let's say, because it would just go out in all directions. It's not going to form a perfectly uniform image. And so that's why Robert Rucker has to propose vertically collimated radiation. It is more like this laser right here. It would be going straight up and straight down. This radiation that's coming out from the body would be going straight up and straight down, parallel to gravity. He primarily proposed this to explain why the carbon-14 dating was off. Because the way that carbon-14 works is through neutrons hitting nitrogen, and then that forms carbon-14. So he primarily proposed this to explain why we have a medieval date with the 1988 carbon-14. He modified it over the years to also account for the image formation. The corona discharge is proposed by Giulio Fanti. And it's similar to the neutron radiation, except he uses a corona discharge. And you see the corona discharge around power transmission lines. And so the heat from the corona discharge discolored the lignin fibers. In the same way, he proposes there was some sort of linear path that the corona discharge did, unlike typical corona discharge. So the issues with the radiation theories, the corona discharge and the neutron radiation, is this ad hoc nature of the vertically collimated radiation. Now, it could happen, but you just have to add this additional proposal. And so, you know, using Occam's razor, hopefully, you know, you would prefer the one that is less ad hoc. It also does not explain the cloth-to-body distance encoding. So if you have a light that's being emitted, you know, whether this laser light or that light itself, you cannot, just by looking at the light, determine the distance. So you at least need 2.2 light sources to triangulate that. But just from one single laser, there's no way to really tell the distance just from that single laser. It also does not explain why is only the top surface of the teeth encoded on it instead of the entire head that's encoded in an X-ray. So the cloth collapse theory was proposed by John Jackson, who was the head of STIRP. And so what he proposes is the body was wrapped in the shroud, and that side strip that I talked about was used to wind around the body and to hold the cloth in place. And then what happened after that, while the body was rigor mortis and before decomposition, the body dematerialized. And when the body dematerialized, when the body disappeared, it would form a vacuum within that shroud. And then because of that vacuum, the cloth would collapse on itself through the body. The top part would collapse down, and the bottom part would collapse up to fill up that vacuum. And so that is how the cloth was going to the body instead of the radiation from the body going to the cloth. So this is not intuitive because this doesn't happen in everyday life. So does this sort of make sense, what I'm proposing? Kind of, okay. We'll have a time for Q&A later. But I do realize this is not an intuitive concept, but just think about it as maybe like a bag of potato chips. You know, you got potato chips inside, and then the potato chips got teleported out, and then all the air inside got teleported out too, and then because of that, there's a vacuum in it, and it just collapsed flat. So it's sort of like the same thing. So during the fraction of a second while the body was dematerializing, the cloth would interact with the dematerializing body, and it would form the image on the cloth. So it explains all these features of the shroud, the photo negative effect. So the cloth is yellow, whitish, and as the cloth was interacting with the body, it oxidized, and then so the parts that oxidized is the parts that touched the body, and then it turned darker. Now the parts that were closer to the body, it interacted with the cloth more. The cloth that was farther away, it interacted with the body less. So that's why there's this change in the discoloration, and that would account for the depth encoding. It also account for the angle encoding, because as the shroud, suppose the body is here and then the shroud was like this, the cloth would collapse down. And then the parts that are the side, it would not collapse as much. And so there's less imaging on the sides. And there'd be more imaging at the top because it was flat that's going down. At the sides, it's just going down like this, and so there's less cloth that is interacting with the body. It explains the X-ray effect and also on the first few millimeters because the cloth did not go through the entire body during the dematerialization process. It was only a fraction of a second that it was able to capture that because the whole process occurred very quickly. It explains hyperrealism. We talked about the side strip. There's no breakage of the blood stains because the body dematerialized, and there's no decomposition because the body dematerialized before it got to the stage of decomposition. So out of all these four theories, I believe the cloth collapse theory best explains the features of the shroud. Now, I will add that it could be possible that neutron radiation was also involved, but I think we can add that without having to add this vertically collimated radiation. So in John 28, it says, "Then went in also the other disciple, which came first to the sepulcher, and he saw and believed." So what did the disciple see, and why did he believe, and what did he believe? This is what I believe he saw, and this is what I saw, and this is why he believed. It's because when the disciple came to the tomb, he looked inside, he saw the linen clothes, the main shroud, and the side strip wound around it. And what he saw looked like the body had simply vanished from within the shroud. It did not look like someone had unwrapped the side strip and opened the shroud. And because he saw that, he says, well, the only way to explain that is the body has simply disappeared. It's as if you took a bag of potato chips, it's not even opened, and there's no chips inside. Automatically, you would think someone teleported all those chips away from it, right? And so he was the first to see this, and he believed in the resurrection. This is what I believe that he believed. So at this point, the shroud, I've argued that the shroud is not medieval. The shroud wraps Jesus of Nazareth, and that through this imaging mechanism of the cloth collapse, it shows that he was resurrected from the dead. And when the disciples came in 33 AD, the beloved disciple saw and believed. Now, one question that has come up is, okay, well, do we have any evidence of the shroud in existence from 33 AD to 1578? 1578 is when the shroud actually entered the Turin Cathedral. So I'm going to talk about this. I also want to add that this is a theory, and I do not use any of this as evidence for the authenticity of the shroud, because this is highly disputed. There's many, many theories on the path of the shroud, but I believe this is a plausible path. And most of this came from Ian Wilson. So again, I am not claiming that any of this points to the authenticity. And the reason I say that is because some of the shroud proponents actually use historical evidence as arguments for the authenticity, but I do not. Okay, so the shroud would have started in Jerusalem, 33 AD, and then gone to Edessa, and in 544, Edessa fell to the Persians, and then in 944, Constantinople reclaimed the shroud from Edessa, but they lost the shroud in 1204 during the fall of Constantinople. And then it traveled to Leary in 1356, around that area, around that time. We don't know exactly when it went over there, but we do know that it existed in Leary, France in 1356. And then it went to Chambéry. There was a fire there in Chambéry. And then finally it arrived in Turin. So I'm going to quickly go through some of the evidence for this. So when the beloved disciple went into the tomb, the Bible doesn't make any mention about the disciples taking the shroud. However, in the Gospel of Hebrews, and it's a lost work, so we don't have any textual evidence of it except for secondhand accounts. And it's been quoted by some of the Alexandrian fathers, Clement, Origen, and Didymus, and Jerome. And in the Gospel of the Hebrews, it says, "And when the Lord had given the linen cloth to the servant of the priest, he went to James and appeared to him." So this is one of the earliest textual evidences of this shroud in existence in the Gospel of the Hebrews.
What chapter and verse is that?
So we don't have that in existence. So this is only quoted by other sources. So, maybe hopefully someone can dig it up sometime and find it, but at this point, we don't have that. Now, there's another legend about King Abgar, and here's a picture of King Abgar. This is on an Armenian banknote. And he was one of the first Christian kings in history. He lived 1st century BCE to AD 50, and he was converted by Thaddeus, one of the 70 disciples. And the legend is that he got healed by the shroud. And this was the Agbar legend. Now, it's just a legend, so we don't know if it's true or false, but there's probably some truth to it. The image of Edessa is something that art historians, they all accept in existence, but it is claimed by Ian Wilson that the image of Edessa and the Shroud of Turin is the same thing. And some dispute that, but I think it's pretty convincing that it's similar. Actually the same thing. It was also known as the Mandylion, and also known as the Acharia Poeta, which is Greek for not made by hand. So all of these items, the image of Edessa, Mandylion, Acharia Poeta, Ian Wilson theorizes that all of these are referring to the Shroud of Turin. Now, obviously, before it was in Turin, it was not called the Shroud of Turin. So it was called something else. So you have to try to do some detective work about, well, what was it called before? After King Abgar, the Edessa reverted to paganism, and it's theorized that the shroud was hidden in a jar and stored in the city wall in Edessa, and that was there for several hundred years. And then it was rediscovered in 525. And what's interesting about that is after that time, the images of Jesus on artwork started to all become very, very similar. And you have to explain, why is that? Why is all artwork of Jesus after that time pretty much all look the same? And this accounts for that, because the shroud emerged at that time. In 544, Edessa was attacked by the Persians and captured, and was so no longer in possession by the Christians. But I find this very interesting, because during the periods of 726 to 787 and 1800s, was the Byzantine iconoclasm. And during those times, the Byzantines destroyed a lot of their artwork. And so coincidentally, this shroud was in pagan hands while the Christians were destroying all of their icons. And I find that to be very interesting. In 943, the Byzantines negotiates with Edessa for the shroud, and they were able to reclaim it. And that happened to be after all of the iconoclasm. In the Fourth Crusade in 1204, Constantinople was sacked. This is very interesting, too. I really didn't study much about the Fourth Crusade, but they should make a Netflix series on this. This is so fascinating. Because why would a Christian pilgrims attack another Christian city? And there's a very interesting story behind that. And so they sacked it, and they took all their stuff, all their money, all their relics, and they took it back to Europe. And so it's theorized a French crusader, probably a Templar, took the shroud back to France. On Friday, October 13, 1307, the French Templars were arrested by King Philip. And one theory as to why we don't like Friday the 13th is probably because it originated from this. And on 1310, 54 Templars were burned at the stake. And then in 1314, the Grand Master Jacques de Molay and Geoffrey de Charnay were burned at the stake. Now, in 1355, there is a different Geoffrey de Charnay who owned the shroud. And he built a church in Lyrie, France. Now, we don't know the connection between the Geoffrey de Charnay that was a Templar and the Geoffrey de Charnay that owned the shroud, but I just tend to suspect there's some sort of correlation there. I don't think it's more like a relative, but I think there's some correlation. Now, his son, Geoffrey II, displayed the shroud in the Lyrie church and started selling souvenirs of it around the late 1350s. Oh, and at this point, with the Geoffrey de Charnay, at this point, even the skeptics acknowledge, okay, this is historical. So it's pretty much before that the skeptics seriously dispute the historical trail. In 1453, Margaret de Charnay, one of the relatives, descendants of Geoffrey de Charnay, sold the shroud to the House of Savoy in exchange for estate revenues and a castle. And the reason I show this is because they obviously thought that the shroud was very valuable. And so for a knight in a small city of Lyrie to be able to acquire this, let's say that he bought it, I don't think that's really feasible, because I don't think he would have had that much money in order to buy it. And why would he show it in a small church in Lyrie? It was just a wooden church. You know, that church doesn't even exist anymore. And so why would he show it in such a small church? In 1502, the shroud was housed in Chambéry. In 1532, there was a fire there, and we see all the major fire burns here. These major fire burns here are from that fire in 1532. And then in 1578, the shroud is moved to Turin, and where it resides to this day. So that is a week three. In our final week, we will cover scripture related to the shroud. and what is the relevance of the shroud to us. So we have some time, and I will open it up for questions, and we don't have a whole lot of time, so if you can keep your questions to less than a minute so we can get to everybody.
Oh, gee, look, I happen to have a microphone. Is gassing radiation, chemical emission, is that common? I mean, when other people die, does that happen?
Gassing.
Marty's out there already. Okay, cool.
Yes. There's actually some images of people who have died in their bed sheets, and the body has been there for a long time, and then the body is decomposed, and then you can see basically just a big stain. You know, it's not a clear image of the image of the body, but it's just a big stain. So we do have gases, fluids coming out of a body, staining a cloth.
Okay. In the scripture account, they describe the fact that when the other disciples got to the tomb, that the linen cloths had been folded neatly and set aside. How do you correlate that to what you were talking about with John's vision, what he saw?
Actually, the way that I read the Bible is it was the head cloth that was folded neatly. Mm-hmm. It was not the shroud. So that's very interesting. And so the head cloth, the sudarium, that was the head cloth. That was the cloth that covered the head. And that was used, I believe, during the transport from when Jesus was on the cross to the tomb itself. There's a couple of purposes for that. One is for modesty, because he was just so severely disfigured. They just wanted to cover the head. Also, they wanted to save all of the blood. So the Jewish tradition is they want to save all the blood, they even do that to this day, so that all of the blood can be buried with the body. So the sudarium was covered over his head when he was taken off the cross, and while they were transporting Jesus to the tomb, he had the sudarium on. When he was in the tomb, Joseph of Arimathea took the sudarium off, folded it, placed it to the side. Then he put the body of Jesus on the shroud and placed him there, and then put the cloth over him. Before that, he was in a state of rigor mortis, and so his arms were like this. And so they had to break the rigor mortis for the arms to come down like this, and then place them on the cloth. And I think this is all conjecture. You know, this is just my own personal theory. But when he broke the rigor mortis, the arms were just sagging like this, and he wanted to put it like this. And so he decided at that point to cut the side strip, that 3-inch side strip. So I believe that side strip was cut after Jesus was placed on the cloth, because the reason I say this is if you look at the image of the Shroud of Turin, the body is centered on the entire cloth. It is, and then including the side strip. So that means that the body was placed on the cloth centered, including the side strip. And then after the fact, he decided to cut off the side strip. And also, this side strip is not a uniform cut. And so it sort of like has various widths as he's cutting it. So it was not done very cleanly. So that's another evidence, I believe, that it was cut after he was laid down. And then that side strip was used to bind the body and to hold everything in place.
Over there.
Oh, over there. Okay.
Oliver,
Closer?
Yep.
Closer. The custody of the shroud, I think, is very important, and it was helpful to have that up there. One of the things you mentioned was Egbar, which is the beginning of your slide. His queen, Helena, became Jewish and lived in Judah in 44, 46, somewhere in that point in time, and during the famine gave food to Israel, but gave a contribution to buy food for all of Judah because of the famine. And she was a very devout Jew, so I think that might be another possible link of how the shroud got all the way out to Egbar. That's in Josephus.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I haven't heard of that. That's good.
The microphone's here. I'll come up there in just a second.
Hey, you mentioned, excuse me, a vacuum. Is there evidence that essentially the mummification process of wrapping bodies would be tight enough to create a vacuum?
Okay. A point of clarification, it wasn't a mummification process, so he wasn't mummified, but it was sort of wrapped, sort of to look like a mummy, but it wasn't a mummification process. So that's a good question. So I wouldn't say it's airtight in terms of the cloth and then the wrapping, but if all of that air and all of the body just simply disappeared, there would have been some sort of vacuum at that process. And then so there would have been a collapse of the cloth. Now, I'm going to go a little bit beyond that and say I also believe it was sort of like a controlled collapse, controlled dematerialization. So because what I mean is it was sort of controlled so that the cloth was going on down like this, up and down like this, so that it wouldn't have been collapsing as much with the sides. So if it just instantly disappeared, the entire body instantly disappeared in a single moment, then maybe it was just crumpled up, all together like this. But I believe that it was more like a controlled dematerialization where the cloth was collapsing in a plain fashion like this.
You answered part of it, but it's hard for me to see how you can put a vacuum on a porous media and collapse it like that. Another thing is that rigor mortis normally takes 24 hours or more before it starts to set in. And didn't the ladies come in and anoint him with various types of chemicals, oils, and things like that that might have stained this?
Okay. So Mary and the other women came in after the Sabbath. But the Bible does not say that they did anything at that time. So they did come, but it doesn't say anything about if they actually did anything. You're talking about the porous nature of the cloth? So it would still have to collapse anyways, because if there was a vacuum there, so I don't believe the air would have been able to go through the cloth fast enough so that it didn't collapse. So I think there would have been some sort of collapse method.
To combine the last two points, to me, in my image, we don't know exactly how the collapse occurred, but it would seem to me like you're just talking about burning something on a cloth. There had to be maybe some kind of energy emitted in this dematerialization, because that would have imprinted the image right permanently on the cloth. And then the rest of it would account, whether it's slow or fast or whatever.
Yeah.
Then after that collapse occurred, and it would account for the porous nature of the cloth also.
Yeah. And also, this theory doesn't fully account for everything. And there's probably some sort of combination of all these things involved. And so that's why I don't really totally discount the neutron radiation either, because that's probably involved. Maybe even the corona discharge is somehow involved as well. So there's maybe a combination of all of these things. But one thing I do like about the cloth collapse is that it accounts for all of these different features.
There was a, and I read this, it just really touched my heart, but about the two, there's a Jewish tradition that when one is at the table and must get up and leave, but they're coming back, that they would take their napkin, maybe which did a whole lot of more than just cover their, protect their lap, but they take their napkin and they would fold it and put it at their place. And that was a sign that they were coming back. If they were not coming back, they just throw it down on the table and leave it. And we find that, yes, when they enter, which gospel it is, I don't remember, but that the face cloth was folded beautifully and laid down on top. The rest we don't, it doesn't say, but the face cloth was folded. And I think that's beautiful. That's, as it was a sign to them, those Jewish people, that Jesus is coming back.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard of that.
Regarding the cloth theory, when I see the image as it's projected up there, it seems as though in a transverse way across it that the image is pretty much uniform all the way across, so from side to side. So that would, to me, suggest that the cloth was wrapped tautly, because normally you think of wrapping cloth is going to have some irregularities, maybe a fold in it. So if a 3-inch strip was used to, let's say, tighten it, is there any evidence that there's some crinkling there that would create some differentiation in that? And then also, to the degree that there was a fire later, how was perhaps smoke introduced into the cloth, and was that measured? And then thirdly, in the head area where the crown is there any evidence of blood, let's say, in that area of the cloth as well?
Oh, yeah. I'll answer those in reverse order. There is evidence of blood everywhere on the head, especially in the back. So it's definitely not like a laurel that's depicted in a lot of artwork, but it's more like a cap of blood stains all around the head. There are actually what I would call second-degree distortions that I believe the cloth collapse theory accounts for. So a lot of the skeptics say, well, you know, his proportions of his face are all wrong. His forehead's too big, or his fingers are too long, or things like that. I believe the cloth collapse theory explains that because of the projection technique that's involved with this. So, like making a map, there's many ways to make a projection of a three-dimensional Earth onto a two-dimensional plane. So there's many different types of maps. So it all depends on the projection method that's used. So this projection method of the cloth collapse, I believe, accounts for those second-degree distortions, like the long head and the long fingers and things like that. Oh, and the smoke. Smoke could have been involved with it as well. And some people theorize that that influenced the carbon-14 dating. It might have, but I like Sue Benford and Joe Marino's theory of the invisible reweave, which accounts for a lot of the different problems. And I've also brought the evidence with Ray Rogers detecting cotton in the sample of the carbon-14. So Smoke could have been involved, but it's not a widely favored view of explaining the 1988 carbon-14 dating.
Oliver, how long in your studies did you find that the body was in the shroud?
How long?
How many hours?
Oh, how many hours? 3 days and three nights, yeah. Before he got resurrected. Now, when we say 3 days and three nights, that's not literal 24 times three. So 3 days and three nights meant, okay, part of a day. So Friday night, Saturday, Sunday. So that would be considered 3 days and three nights.
Oliver, as far as tracking where the shroud was, my recollection is there was some evidence in the study about traces of pollen showing that it was in those locations at various times.
Yeah.
Could you speak to that?
Yeah, good observation. Notice in my past 3 weeks, I never even talked about the pollen. I never even talked about the coins. So I've been intentional in that because those are disputed by the shroud skeptics. And so I've decided to not include that because it's disputable evidence. Some people claim it's good evidence, but I've decided not to use any evidence that the skeptics will say, okay, that's not good evidence. But I do believe there's pollen there. Max Fry is the one who did the pollen research, and he was a pioneer in this field. And so the skeptics like to just make fun of him because of all these things, that mistakes that he made. But come on, you know, he was the first guy who to do this. And so he can't figure out everything. So I give Max Fry a lot of credit, and I believe in his work, but I don't present that as evidence. All right, we have time for one more, and then we have to pass this off to the
one more
next speaker.
Do you have it? Okay, I've got one over here.
Okay, last one.
Man, we run a tight ship here, huh?
Otherwise, they're not going to bring me back to the fourth week.
So it occurs to me that so much of the evidence is based on science. And God is so much capable of things beyond our comprehension. So to what extent have theories been developed that explains the unexplainable?
I can't explain that.
And on that note,
we're going to end with that question. Yeah.
Come back for week four.
Now, next week, I'm going to be talking about this all from a scriptural point of view, which I think is very, very interesting. Because the relevance of this to me is it illuminates scripture. And I'll just give you a teaser about this. Is in the fourth week, it doesn't matter if you believe if it's a fake or real. It doesn't matter if you believe if it's authentic or it's actually a medieval fake, because either way, it illuminates scripture. And that is going to be very, very interesting. And that's what I'll be presenting in the fourth week.
Thank you, Oliver. Let's thank him for his presentation. And let's give John Dance a warm welcome with Fully Furnished Ministries.
Hi, everyone. I know you. I'm John Dance, the Executive Director for Fully Furnished Ministries. I know that you're ready to kind of go, but I just ask you to give me just a few minutes to talk about our ministry. And I really don't like being up here. I'm going to stay down here. And I'd like to walk around. And let's talk about ministry and how you can be, you can impact it and continue to impact our community. I'm going to ask you to do something. Just trust me for a minute. Just trust me. I know you don't know me, most of you, but just trust me. I want you to just close your eyes for a minute. Just close your eyes. What I want you to do is I want you to imagine, just imagine your house today, the one you just left this morning, right? You just left this morning, and you got your furniture in it. You got your bed, your dresser, your dining table and chairs. I want you to see it, okay? You got it? All right, open your eyes. That was quick. So you trust me. All right, now I want you to imagine, and when you're headed home, you're going to get home, and everything you just imagined and you remembered is gone. It's gone. Absolutely gone, okay? It's gone because of a fire. It's gone because of a flood. It's gone because of nothing that you did. It's just, it's gone. And now you got to think about how you're going to start over again. That's what we do. So we work with churches and other nonprofits in Area Perimeter, which is where this ministry started, with your deacons, what do you call them? Deacons board, deacons. This is where it started over 22 years ago. It's right here at this church. Someone called in with the idea of, hey, I have an appliance. Someone called and a few hours later said, I need that appliance. And the idea was born, how do we bring those two worlds together? Now, what we think sometimes is that those two worlds are hundreds and thousands of miles apart, those who have a need and those who have what they need, right? We think they're hundreds of miles apart. They're not. They're right down the street from each other. We literally drive by it every day. We just don't get the context or we don't get the chance to interact with each other in doing that. And that's what we do. We are able to bring those two worlds together. So on a given Saturday, we'll go out, also during the week, we'll go out and we'll pick up furniture and we'll deliver furniture to these families who have a need. The example I gave you earlier was an example where four families, in fact, right there in Norcross, they left their home that morning, went to work, apartment building caught on fire. They come home, the kids get off the bus. This is right in Norcross, 3-4 months ago. 42 people were displaced, and most of them were kids, single moms and kids, and they got to start over again. And I'm always reminded when Jesus tells us, when the disciples were asking them, who sinned, right? When he was healing this man, and they decided, who sinned that caused this? And Jesus said, nobody did. Nobody sinned. And what I call that is life just sometimes comes knocking. Just as you just close your eyes and you can see your stuff, sometimes nothing you've done, life just comes knocking. And it just says, hey, life is like, yo, I'm going to go visit John Dance today. And he comes knocking. I'm like, yo, I didn't do anything. You know, don't go bother me. But it just comes knocking. Now this person doesn't have anything, but it got a great church like Perimeter, who's one of our biggest partners, and they will come alongside that family and help them to get, get in a place to live, right? And then we become the arm of that, and they'll contact me, my organization, and say, hey, can you now help fill this house with furniture? And we say, yes, we can come alongside that. Why? Because this single mom, for the most part, this single mom with her kids, she's making decisions every day now. She's making a decision, do I get my kid off the floor with a bed, or do I make sure the lights stay on? Well, that's an easy decision for us. We're going to make sure the lights stay on so the kid has to sleep on the floor. Do I give my kid off the floor to do his homework on sitting on a sofa, or do I keep my water running? Well, that's an easy answer for us. We're going to make sure that water stays on, and so the kid has to do his homework on the floor. Do I give my child and my family a table to sit at, or do I make sure they have food? Well, that's easy for us. So they're making these decisions, and these decisions can go on for days. Some of these people are coming out of extended stays, which I could give you a whole sermon on that. But they're coming out of extended stays where they've gone into this place, and they think that I'm going to be in there for 2 weeks. Well, guess what happens? 2 months go, two years go by, and they're still living in that extended stay. 3 years, 4 years. Now imagine a child in that environment, now that they have a place to find, an organization to help them find a place to live, but now they're moving and everything they had was in that extended stay. The bed, the dressers, all of it. But now they're moving and they have a place to live, and that's where we come alongside them. So now it comes to where do you help? How can you help? how you can help, continue to help us. And you guys do a tremendous amount, because financially, a lot of you give to Fully Furnished Ministries, and I am thankful, and I thank you for that, because it helps us, as they say, to keep the lights on. Right? It really does. It keeps our trucks running, tools to take care of different things, to paint and to deliver that furniture. So thank you. How you can continue to help us is there's three things that we need continually. We cannot get them fast enough. As fast as we get them, they are gone, because families have that need. We need beds. We have the tremendous need for beds. We're one of the few organizations to actually handle and deliver beds. So we make sure they're clean. We pick them up clean. We make sure that they're not ripped, they're not torn, they're not stained. So we're not giving away stuff like that. Why? Because we want to give our best, right? Why want you and give them their best? They don't have anything. Yeah, they're still God's kids. They're still God's kids, right? Yeah, they don't have anything, but they're still God's kids. And so I say to the volunteers, we want to give our best because God gave us his best. He gave us his absolute best. Do you ever think of that God didn't save us with a cat? He didn't save us with a dog? He could have, right? He could have. Who asked that question? Can you explain? Well, yeah, no, we can't. But we can explain his love, his grace, his mercy. We can explain that. And we tell that every day when we go out in our interactions with the people that we pick up furniture from. And some of you, who has donated furniture in here before to us? So you guys know, right? We pick up that furniture and we give that same grace and that same love and that same mercy as we're picking it up. And what you've seen in those who raise their hands, that's the same love, grace, and mercy we give to those people that we're bringing your furniture to. That same love and that same grace and that same mercy. Beds are the number one thing, because we want to get these kids off the floor. As I said to you earlier, the kids, those kids with no sofa, no dresser, no dining table, no beds, those same kids have to get up each morning and go and compete at school. Imagine that. They got to go compete. They still are expected to know everything, as the same kid who lives in a $200,000, $300,000 home who has everything. Now, I say that because it's not to place guilt on anyone. Why? Because it all belongs to God. All of it. Everything we have belongs to him. There's nothing we've done. Not one thing that I've done that gives me a house in Decula. Nothing. And I'm reminded of that. So what do? I give back. Why? Because God's blessed me. I don't know why. Mr. Unexplained, who is that? And can you explain, right? I don't know why. I just know that he did it. And I'm reminded that God tells us, blessed are those who have not seen and still believe. That's what that reminded me of today. We haven't seen it. We can't explain it, but we still believe. Beds are the number one. Number two are dressers. Dressers we need. We go through dressers like this. Families need, if four, on average, four kids, a mom. That's how many dressers we need. That's how many beds we need. That's how fast we go through them. The third thing we need is dining tables and chairs. Dining table and chairs, same thing. We just go through them as fast as we can get them, because families just doesn't have them. So my prayer to you today is that you think about the things that you do have, right? How God has blessed you, and give of those things. Bedding, everybody's got bedding. Everybody's got bedding. We take bedding, we work with a cleaners, and we actually get it clean. Everybody's got bedding. Dishes, everybody's got dishes, okay? Look in your cabinets and say, man, I haven't touched that in five Christmases, right? It happens. I know. I got it too. I'm guilty too. We get it down. We box it up, and you call me. And if you got other furniture and stuff, or you can bring it by the warehouse, we'll take it and we put that to good use. We have great volunteers that come down on Tuesday from 9:30 to about 12:30, and they actually put this stuff together. So those are the three things. And the last two areas I'll ask that you can give and how you can participate with us, I guess I should say. It's every Tuesday from 12:30 to about from 9:30 to about 12:30, we have a team of volunteers that come down to the warehouse, and they actually paint, they tighten things up, they sand things down, they get labels of kids and, you know, left on the dressers before. They make sure, because, again, we want to give our best. And if you're looking for something to do on a Tuesday, now you're going to try to say, well, John, I know I can't move furniture, right? I can't move furniture. I'm not 21 years old like you. Okay, you're not 21 years old like me. But you're 25, okay? So what I'm going to ask you to do is come down and just spend time and just give back. It is such a blessing to see that team come together every Tuesday. It's about 20 of them. They come down on Tuesday. Most of them, again, are from Perimeter Church. They come down on Tuesday and do that. You're welcome to come. The second area, of course, is what you continue to do, and just to continue to give to us financially. That's such a blessing, and it helps us to do the things that we need to do as we go out each and every day, each and every week. And as we go out, I like to say, God tells us, you know, go into all the world. Go into all the world. We go out into all the world. And what we'd like you to do, when we go out and when you're participating with us, you go out with us too. Okay? So if you can, again, think about the stuff that you have in storage units, in your garage that you keep looking at, all those different things, just think about those things and call us, contact us. We're on your website. I'm sure we're on your church website. And we'll be more than glad to come out and actually get those things for you. Okay? All right. That's all I have. Thank you. I got one hand here. Okay. Okay. Yep. Yep. Yes. Yes. So to this, I'm going to say guilty, guilty, guilty. Right? I'm going to say that. And I don't know how long ago that was. Recently, okay. But we now have three, thanks to this church and a number of churches, we have three trucks, and we're running Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday. So we're running 4 days a week. We're doing that, okay? We knew that was an issue. And what I would tell you is, if you're getting that or someone says to you, you call in or you email our people and they say, well, you're outside of our zip code. I'm sure you probably got that too, right? All you have to say is, I want you to say this, okay? Get ready. I want you to say this. John Dance said, that's what I want you to say. Oh, no, 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 no. I'm not out of your zip code, because John Dance said, I want you to use that as many times as you want to use it. And when we see that John Dance said, they know, okay, we got to take care of this. They know, okay? That's like an ace that you have that you can throw down and throw down, and I don't care how many times you play it. I want you to say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. John Dance said you could pick this stuff up. And we're going to do, and then we're going to get on the phone with you, okay? It's not going to be emailing back and forth. Why? God's blessed us. I now have a warehouse manager who is unbelievable, okay? Starting Tuesday, we're going to have a warehouse supervisor. Unbelievable. We got four guys that's running two trucks during the course of the week. We got a team of five trucks that run on Saturday. We continue to grow because God's blessed us. And I truly believe he does that because when we are blessed, we just continue to bless others. And as long as we're giving, as long as you're saying John Dance said, and we're reacting to that, we're going to make that happen. And I'm telling you, I really want you to say that. Even in your, if you're typing it up online and where you put down in that box where it says, what items do you have to give? I want you to start with John Dance said, okay? I want you to do that, and we're going to make that happen, okay? Thank you for that, okay? Yes?
If we have smaller things like the linens and the lamps and furnishings, can we drop them off?
Yes, you can drop them off, yes.
When?
So normally we say Tuesday, really Tuesday through Saturday. You can drop them off from about 9 to about 2 o'clock, somewhere in that window. But again, You can also, when you go online, to put that down, or you want to just come, just contact us and say, hey, you know what? I can't make 2 o'clock, but I can make 4 o'clock, right, for whatever reason. And John Dance said, so you got to say, and we're going to make sure that somebody's there to receive it if you've got it on that given day. Okay? Okay? Anything else? You're not going to remember this. Do we have that? It's on the website. You can go to the website and find that. Okay? Anything else? Continue to give. God bless you. I want to leave you one thing. Can I close them out? Are you okay with me doing that? Praying over them? Okay, let me do that. What I want to just share with you, I'm going to close you with the scripture. And this is Matthew 5:16. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. What does that say to me? What that says to me is, we sometimes get confused in thinking that it's about us. And we think that it's our story. It's not our story. It's God's story. Everything we do, it's God's story. So what does God do? God says, John Dance, I want you to go down and talk to Perlman today. He's weaving his story. Terry and Deborah, I want you to invite John down to talk to them. He's weaving his story. Fritz, I want you to allow John to speak today. He's weaving his story. I want you to allow John to close in prayer. He's weaving his story. Why? Because it's his story. It's not our story. It's God's story. And for all those families that you're helping support and that you give furnishings to, he's weaving his story. He's taking you and saying, I want you in this lady's life who lives 20 miles down the road from you. You don't even know her, but I'm going to use you today to give up a dresser that you're going to let go. I'm going to weave you into that story because it's God's story. It is not ours. It is not ours. It's his. It all belongs to him. All of it. And I'm just asking you, just take a second. Remember that. And it's not about guilt. It's about you're blessed. Recognize him in giving of your time and giving him your treasure because you're blessed. I'm blessed. I'm blessed too. And I have to give that away. Why? Because God gave us his best. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you. I thank you for this time to speak to this group of your children who may know nothing about this piece that you're doing, but they know you and they love you. And you're that conduit between me and between them. And I ask you to bless them as they go today. All that they put their hands to, God, let it just be for your glory. Remind us that it's about you. It's not about what we're doing. It's about what you're doing and how you trust us enough to say, I want you in my story. I'm going to weave you into my story by the simple thing that you do and give. Lord, we love you and we honor you with this time. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless you.